As an unlicensed doctor, we suggest a prescription for one of our shows. Sign up for our free podcast at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Fake Doctor's Orders. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. It's a magazine you don't have to feel obligated to buy from your nephew's fundraiser. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, free on your radio. Now. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Saturday to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Johnston. And I am back from my sojourn to warmer climes. It's a little different temperature.
You're nice and tanned.
But, really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I haven't heard that. I was using SPF 60, so I don't know. I guess I could be more tanned. But yeah, it feels kind of good to be back. Good to see
like
you guys.
Looks like a man that's been hot for a while.
I feel like you're coming on to me, but I appreciate it. It feels good to be back. Good to talk a little sports. I kind of, you know, as much as it was fun being away, I missed a whole lot that week. That was an exciting week with the Randy Carlisle stuff, the Phil Kessel blow up.
You missed like three Leafs goals the whole week you were away.
Right. Ever since I've returned, they've had a little more trouble putting the puck in the back of the net. We'll get to the Leafs. Raptors blown out again last night and some serious concerns surrounding that team all of the sudden. It is conference championship weekend in the NFL, and the Blue Jays with some curious moves yesterday and curious treatment of their new third baseman. We'll get to all that in the next couple of hours, and then I will take you through until 1 o'clock before Samet and Russick step in. All right, so the Maple Leafs will wrap up this murderous, horrible, terrible, worst ever road trip ever tonight in St. Louis, and you can hear it on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Hockey Nation starting at 5 o'clock, and of course on Hockey Night in Canada at 6:30. Could not score through the first two games in California, finally get on the board in San Jose, but lose that one 3-1, so they've lost six of their last seven, just one win over Peter Horacek, but, and we'll get to the idea of blowing it up in just a second, but let's just talk about the play recently, but you know, they are limiting shots on goal. And everything that Randy Carlisle preached and said that was the only way this team was going to win, and everything everybody was saying and all the analytics people were saying, under Peter Horacek, they've actually made that happen, save for, you know, the back end of back-to-backs in San Jose. Jordan.
Yeah, you know what's funny is that if you remember last year when the Leafs went out to the West Coast under Randy Carlisle, when they're in great shape, sort of close to the top of the conference, and they won two of those three games, and they were getting outshot horribly, but they were winning games. And, you know, everybody was like, well, I mean, they might be getting outshot, but if they can go to the West and beat these teams, then there's no telling what could happen. And now they've made the change. They go out West. They play much better. They limit the shots against. They get more chances, but they lose all three games. And so you have to kind of trust the process here. Rome's not built in a day. These Maple Leafs haven't been built in 9 years. So you just kind of got to be patient a little bit. I was personally not super excited to see the way that they played because it's not exciting hockey, but I think this fan base is going to have to get used to not exciting hockey, but maybe that helps them get better in the long term.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, you look at the way this team has played, it's not exciting right now, and there are people that said the only way they can score goals is to play that fire wagon hockey. Do you believe that?
Well, they've scored one goal in three games, and they're not playing fire wagon hockey, so that says something, but I think it's good to see the silver lining of a situation in life and in sports. Getting a little philosophical on you, but
I feel better already.
Exactly. So it's nice, and the team should and the fans should take small victories in the sense that overall they're playing better in certain areas of the ice. But at the end of the day, that's not going to help you this season. It might be a good trend going forward, if this is the type of team the Leafs want to build the next few years, if Brendan Shanahan likes what he's seeing, this is what fans are going to start seeing for the rest of the season and into next season. But it's not going to help you get into the playoffs this year.
But that's okay, right? I mean, it's not the be all and end all to get in the playoffs this year.
Well, why not try to get into the playoffs?
I'm sure they're trying.
Well, why won't it help them this year? I mean, Yes, I know it hasn't gone well in California, but it doesn't go well for a lot of teams in California. Those are some pretty good teams. If they continue playing this way, the number guys will tell you, Stephen Birch will tell you, that they are still getting lots of scoring opportunities. They are not potting those opportunities. And yes, I know it looks like they're giving up offense for defense, but the opportunities are there, and eventually the goals will come under this,
well,
under this system.
Well, their shooting percentage has been way down on this trip. Right. Opposing goalie save percentage has been way up. It's bad luck for them, essentially, that the pucks they are putting at the net are not going in. You know, there was that puck that just sat on the goal right. line there in San Jose, and those are the things that eventually will turn around and even out. And so if they trust the process, they'll be okay. I think the larger question is, for the way Horacek wants to play and the way Shanahan and the analytics guys upstairs want them to play, is this the right personnel to do it? And I think that beyond about five or six guys that you probably want to keep around, I think there's nobody that should be necessarily safe.
I would generally agree with you that this team, you know, it doesn't seem like the team is able to play a defensive style. But then I look at some of the games recently. I mean, that Kings game that they lost 2-0, it was a snoozer of a game, but they could have easily won that game. There was one goal scored against a goalie. It was an empty netter, end up losing 2-0. They could have easily, they had opportunities to score in that game, could have won that game against the defending Stanley Cup champions. Is it just a cop-out to say that this team can't play a defensive style of hockey, Mike?
I think so. They have guys, even guys that are underperforming. David Clarkson, he can play a defensive game. He can play a grinding style. He's the type of guy that in this, you know, not so much run-and-gun game, in a more conservative style that they're obviously trying to implement, he's a guy that can have success. And there are others on the team as well that can do that. But part of it's luck, like what you said, that goal against San Jose, the puck was just there, and nothing's going their way. If that puck doesn't go in, nothing's going your way.
Nothing's gone their way for like 47 years.
Yeah, that's true as well. Good point. But, and you say scoring chances have gone up. Phil Kessel had some great, you know, quality scoring chances, open looks at the net, and he's not scoring. Phil Kessel scores those goals. Even when the team's not playing well, historically, Phil Kessel keeps scoring, right? He has, I think it's 2 goals in the last month, and he's still getting the chances. So it's not, you would think, just based on sheer odds, that if they keep playing this way and keep getting the chances, the pucks are going to go in. In theory, that's true.
It'll get better. It'll get better as it goes, but it's not going to get good enough.
Good enough to make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference?
Good enough to contend for the Stanley Cup. And
oh,
I know,
well, yeah.
You're
okay,
going to go, good,
sure.
But isn't that what you want to do? I mean,
right,
anybody can sneak into the playoffs and hope to win a round, and anything can happen. You know, we've seen 8 seeds win the cup a few times, but,
or at least get to a cup final. Yeah.
Well, we've seen the Kings did it as an 8 seed.
Yeah.
They won the cup. I mean,
that
that's
was a
the
bit
Western
of an anomaly.
Conference.
Yeah.
But I think any team that makes the playoffs has a chance. But the question is the Leafs making the playoffs right now is something that's going to depend on luck, right? It's going to depend on those bounces going their way and them being able to keep playing at a high level and Bernier to stand on his head some nights. And while that's all well and good, and it makes them competitive, it doesn't bode well for the core of this team, which I think it's pretty much been proven now is not going to become the kind of team that you can build around. You can use these pieces to build something, but you have to have a core there. It's almost like it's a core without the most important pieces.
Yeah, they certainly have still never found that number one center. I guess everybody in the NHL is looking for that number one center.
Or number one defenseman.
Now, the argument could be, and we've all heard, you know, last couple of years, the 18-wheeler going off the cliff, right? The 18-wheeler, I guess you could argue, has gone off the cliff already for this team. It's play over the last couple of weeks. It's cost Randy Carlyle his job. But is there an argument to be made that it's coming at a better time than it normally comes? Like last year, it came a little too late where you couldn't sell off enough pieces. You couldn't dump enough pieces. You couldn't stockpile enough draft picks. There's enough time here before the trade deadline that you can cut some dead wood off of this team and look forward to the future, and finally do that thing that is so difficult for Toronto sports teams to do and make a decision, not just be in the middle. Jordan, is there enough time here now that this slump has come and they are 5 points back of that last playoff spot in the Eastern Conference. This is actually a good thing.
Well, it's better timing than it usually is, for sure, because usually this comes in, and there's four games left in the season and you're all of a sudden on the outside looking in and it's another wasted year. So in that sense, at least they have enough time, enough breathing room to perform a thorough analysis of the team and see where they really want to go. My question to that, though, is that if you're going to be making all these moves before the deadline, is Dave Nonis the guy you want making those moves? He's not Shanahan's guy. He didn't seem to agree with the analytics guys who were largely brought in because he was making poor analytics decisions. And you want to leave the rebuilding of a team that was largely built by him and Brian Burke in the hands of the guy that built it the wrong way in the first place? That seems a little strange.
But didn't we already at the beginning of the season understand that he wasn't even the man pulling the strings in large part? There was.
Well, why is he still there then, though?
It's a good question. And maybe he won't be at the end of this season, but don't.
But then if he's not going to, this is what I'm saying, if he's not going to be there at the end of the season, why do you trust the pre-trade deadline rebuilding to a guy that you're planning to kick out 2 weeks or 2 months from now?
I think the hiring of Kyle Dubas and the like has proven that they don't trust him to make any decisions. And everything has to go through Brendan Shanahan anyways, right? So I think that says enough to us that this Maple Leafs brass does not trust Dave Nonis to get the job done when it comes to rebuilding this team, Mike.
You know what? He's like any GM on a mid-level team. He's made some moves like Mike Santorelli. That proved to be a great signing, and I don't think anyone's going to dispute that. At the end of the day, really, at the end of the day, it comes down to how the players are playing. And you can blame Nonis all you want. You can, you know, Randy Carlyle was a scapegoat for the organization's troubles. I don't think necessarily firing the GM now is the right move. Otherwise, why not just get rid of him and Carlyle on the same day? I think if they really wanted a massive overhaul, all right, we're cleaning house, they would do it. They would just rip the Band-Aid off all at once. I think Brendan Shanahan likes Dave Nonis or trusts Dave Nonis enough to see, just to see how he handles the rest of the season, because there are players on this team that the Leafs should trade. If they lose tonight in St. Louis, which, if I was a gambling man, I would put some money on the Blues. The Leafs are certainly not favored to win. If they continue this, luckily, like you said, the Leafs, this is the time of year teams decide whether they're buyers or sellers, and they're trending in the direction of sellers. And the Leafs have some parts, expiring contracts, Cody Franzen, maybe even Santorelli you could get. He's a guy you might want, but you could get some parts for him. They're going to have to start moving and pull Dave Nonis is going to have to pull off, I would say, one or two pretty significant trades in order to show Brendan Shanahan, I'm willing to make some difficult decisions to stay here. But I don't think firing Dave Nonis is the right call at this stage of the year, because if it was, why not just do it a couple weeks ago when you fired Carlyle?
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason behind firing Carlyle when they did is because they wanted to get a sense of whether this roster that Dave Nonis had built and the signings that they made, whether it was a failed roster that simply wasn't going to be able to succeed, or whether it was a collection of reasonably talented players that, when coached better, could actually make a difference. And I think you have seen a little bit of that improvement. So they're trying to get a real assessment of them now.
Wouldn't you have liked to have seen that system implemented at the beginning of the season and seen what they could have done against teams other than the three that play in California?
Yeah,
to get a better sense of, you know, oh, maybe if they limited the opponents to under 30 shots a game all season long, maybe they wouldn't be in the exact situation that they're in. So maybe that was the mistake of this team and this franchise, and Brendan Shanahan not pulling the plug before the season and putting a guy in who could play. Listen, I was among those that was kind of questioning whether, you know, firing the coach, how much of this could really be on Randy Carlyle. But the numbers are stark. It's unbelievable, really.
It's not unbelievable, though. If you look at Randy Carlyle's teams in his history, he's consistently been a coach that is on the lower end of the possession spectrum. And he's consistently, when he's won by having an overwhelming number of great players, which is obviously not something he was blessed with in Toronto. But I was on the same boat last year, probably around this time. I thought it became pretty clear that the Leafs system or lack of one was not conducive to consistently maintaining possession. And that if that's the case, you have to look elsewhere than the coach. And it was honestly stunning to me that he was held on over the summer and brought back for this year, because I thought it was pretty clear that they'd sort of, their ceiling under Randy Carlyle with this core was like a 7 or 8 seed.
And now we're in the middle of the season, and Maple Leafs 7 points back of a playoff spot, and a long way to go as far as getting back into one of those wild card positions in the Eastern Conference. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Johnston. So the question now becomes, gentlemen, and Damian Cox wrote about it on Sportsnet.ca, talked about it on the radio yesterday, and the conversation will continue, especially if the losses continue to pile up. Will this finally be the year they just throw a stick of dynamite into this team and blow it up once and for all? Try and trade away as many pieces as possible and strip it down to the bare bones, just the younger players, you know, maybe even Nazem Kadri, if you decide he's not a part of this core, can be thrown overboard. But you keep guys like Morgan Riley, obviously William Nylander, Stuart Percy, the youngest players on this roster, and everybody else can be thrown overboard. And you're looking at a 3 to 5 year, you know, wallowing in standings misery for this team, something we've never seen before, but would allow it to draft in the top five of the next 3 drafts. And knowing what we know about trades and free agency in the NHL, seemingly the only way you can get good players. Is this finally, Mike, the time we're going to see that with this team? Is that the right move for this team?
I don't think it's the right move if blowing up the team means trading Phil Kessel, if it means trading Dion Phaneuf, if it means trading James Van Riemsdyk. I know those Kessel and Phaneuf, those were the two big names that have been brought up recently. They're on long-term contracts. And also right now, first of all, a big deal like that isn't going to come mid-season. That's going to come before the draft. That's going to come in the off-season. But right now, all the trade talk around those guys, Phil Kessel's stock is probably at an all-time low right now. And the only way it could get lower is if he suffered an injury that would put his future in doubt. He's, you know, struggling, at least statistically, right now. What Nonis should do, what Shanahan should look at, is if you want to blow it up, you look at guys like Kadri. You look at guys like Joffrey Lupul, like Cody Franz, and something you can get a decent return for, whether it's a roster player and a prospect, a high draft pick, and a good young player. These are players teams would want for a long playoff haul. And I think those are the players that the Leafs should look to move if they want to make some big moves. You get your second line players. You get your second line of defense. Obviously, a guy like Morgan Riley is untouchable. There's no point in putting like Leo Komarov out there. No one's going to take David Clarkson's contract. The Kadris, the Lupuls, the Franzens.
Nobody wants Lupul either.
I think outside of injuries, Lupul's a very effective player.
The injuries. You can't talk about Joffrey Lupul without talking about the injuries.
This is true. And I'll lump Jake Gardner in there as well. You could get a significant return for Jake Gardner. And I think when you have somebody like a Morgan Riley, like a more steady defenseman, you have Stuart Percy in the system, you have more steady defensemen that don't take as many risks. That's the type of blue line I think this team should start building, and maybe get rid of a guy like Gardner, and because you can get a huge return for these guys.
And now that you've signed Jake Gardner to that big deal and he hasn't proven that he's got the ability to live up to anything, if I'm an opposing GM looking to score somebody from the Leafs, I'm not looking to a guy that they probably signed too early for too much money. I'm not saying that Jake Gardner will never be a good player. I certainly think he has all the tools, and maybe he just needed a change of coach, and maybe he'll start showing it here over these next few games. But nobody's eager to sign up for what is he? Is he making four and a half?
He's making his average of just over 4.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody's quite eager to sign up to that when he hasn't really proven much. When we're talking about the Leafs, my initial reaction is to just say boom. There's not a lot here to build around. There are good pieces. I don't think, as Mike said, you don't trade Morgan Riley for anything because he's got the potential to be your number one defender. He's not there yet, but he's got the potential. You don't trade Jonathan Bernier because I think he's showing that he can develop into a number one goalie. You don't trade Nazem Kadri because he might be the only guy outside of Phil Kessel on this team that has true game-changing offensive talent. And you don't trade James Van Riemsdyk because he's a big body that can score around the net, and you need that to win in the playoffs. Beyond that, I look down this roster, and I don't see anything that's significant to a contending team. There are some nice pieces that they've acquired. Komarov could probably help a team as a third-line scrapper in the playoffs. You know, guys like David Booth and Mike Santorelli can certainly contribute to teams that need them on their back six to kind of drive possession, and they've proven that they can do that. But, you know, you talk about acquiring your second-line guys by trading guys like Lupul and stuff like that. That's fine, but you don't have first-line guys. You know, beyond Phil Kessel, who can get you 30 goals and maybe 40 goals and not a lot of defense, beyond that, you don't have guys who you're looking to who, just to put it in perspective, to look at the players on really good contending teams,
right,
like Anze Kopitar, Jonathan Toews, guys who can play against the best opposition and score goals against the other team's best players. They don't have, it doesn't exist
You have to draft those players.
Right. There's no other way to get them, right? You can't sign them in free agency because nobody good gets to free agency anymore.
Corey Perry thought about it.
Yeah.
He thought about it once. That might have been good for Leaf fans. Leaf fans like,
and people like to point at Steven Stamkos as being the big target. I'd be shocked if
I'd be shocked as well. Yeah,
the Lightning don't lock him up to, you know, whatever 40-year deal, like all the superstars in the NHL do. So
what's the point then in trading for second line talent when you don't have first line talent? Aren't you then like moving a guy like Kadri or Gardner, who could potentially be a first line talent, for guys who you know are going to be second-line talent? That smacks to me of doing the same old trying to get into the playoffs now at the cost of maybe developing a real core that you can build around. And I think that's already been proven over the last, like, 9 years to be a failed strategy.
Well, we've never seen it here in Toronto, right? With any of these franchises, nobody's ever stripped it to the bare bone.
Now, the Raptors tried to, and it turned out great.
Right. It absolutely did. So maybe that was a little karma. Maybe that's, you know, you do it the right way and the sporting gods smile upon you, and maybe it'll happen with the Maple Leafs if they decide to go that way. Because who knows? I mean, the Eastern Conference with some young players, you know, maybe in a couple of years it's a quicker rebuild than you realize. But it's never happened. And the question is always, well, this, you know, city wouldn't stand for it. I don't believe that. I think we all understand that people would still fill that barn down
at the ACC.
They're
standing for an awful lot right now.
Right. I mean, the only question I would have is that the owners of this team, majority owners, are media companies, and they have TV rights. And I wonder if the TV rights and the TV numbers would slightly dip if you're looking at a team that is, you know, bottom 3, 4, 5 in the Eastern Conference for the next 3 years. Or is it more compelling television knowing that you're looking at a young team with some potential in the future, and they are the underdog every night, and maybe there's more to like that way, as opposed to this team, which seemingly has no chance going on a California road trip? What is more intriguing, Jordan?
Well, I think, you know, when you look at teams in Toronto and you want to say, well, if this team doesn't perform up to expectations, you know, the TV numbers aren't going to be there and they're going to have to make some moves in order to attract the fans. But I've honestly never seen it with the Maple Leafs. You know, it's hard to imagine a worse 9-year skid or so than they've had, barring that one playoff appearance against the Bruins. And television numbers never went anywhere. They're still the most watched team in Canada by quite a wide margin, whether they're winning or losing. And
so why hasn't it happened here?
I think it hasn't happened here because the ownership and the general managers, by and large, have been rotated so much that they're playing for their playing. They're managing for their jobs, right? If they don't deliver results, they're on their way out, so nobody wants to commit to a rebuild.
When Brian Burke arrived in Toronto, everybody talked about, oh, well, okay, it's time to build from, you know, he was given a 5-year deal.
But that's not what he said.
Exactly. Why didn't he? Everybody here was ready for that to happen. And he talked about, well, I want to, you know, win quickly or do the slow build quickly or whatever.
But Brian Burke's never been a guy.
It's not fast food. It's good food quickly. But, I mean, it just never happened. General managers have been given the rope. Seemingly every time a new one steps into the job, the expectation is they'll blow it up. They'll start from scratch. It never has happened. Brian Burke hasn't done it. Now Dave Nonis is, you know, still an extension of Brian Burke. Let's not forget. Is the next guy going to do it? Is Brendan Shanahan going to finally have the stones, Mike, to say enough is enough? Let's blow this thing up. This core stinks. For whatever reason, these guys can't play together. They can't get it together. This team will never be a contender the way it's constituted. The only way to get the players we need is through the draft. Let's finally do it. Does Brendan Shanahan, Mike, have the stones to do that?
You look at all the suspensions he handed down. He's got the stones. He's a Mimico boy. Of course he does.
Sure.
But in theory, blowing up a franchise is okay. It works. You're going to get high draft picks and it'll take time, but yeah, sure. In theory, it works. The thing with the NHL, more than any other professional sports league in North America, the parity, there's so much parity in the NHL that a mid-level team like the Leafs, they have a realistic shot.
Oh, but isn't that the trap you get every year?
Yes, and that's the problem. That's why so many teams stay in the middle. That's why the Leafs are, they contend for a playoff spot because there's so much parity. They actually have a chance. You look at the standings, they're 5 points out. That's just a three-game win streak, and you're right back in it.
The giant trap of the NHL, right? You can do it, you just have to sneak in the playoffs, and then you look up every year, and it's the Blackhawks and the Kings and the teams that are really at the top of the food chain.
And this is why these rebuilds are so rare, is because there's always that sliver of hope. And why not, if you're an NHL team and you're thinking about playoff revenue and you're thinking about let's just get in, because that's the goal of every team, is let's just get into the playoffs. If it's right there, it would be natural for you to hesitate blowing it up if you're right there. It's like, because if you blow it up, you don't make the playoffs, and then the next season you're not a playoff team. You might go, oh man, we were so close last year.
That was our year.
If only we didn't blow everything up and move all these pieces, we could have been in the playoffs, and we'd be in a better spot today than we are.
But let's put
that's the conundrum.
Put it in a larger context in the Eastern Conference for a second, because I think when you look at the Leafs and you try to ascertain whether this is a roster that you want to continue to build on or blow up, you have to look at what's around them. And it's difficult to look, because obviously the Penguins aren't going anywhere. And then you look at a few of the teams that they're competing against, not the top, top, top tier, but the teams that they would consider their traditional rivals. And the Canadiens, the Lightning, the Red Wings, and the Islanders have all shifted towards a younger core over the last year or two.
Islanders are doing a great job.
The Islanders are doing a fantastic job. You know, the Lightning are now playing Kucherov and Palat and Johnson. The Red Wings have all these young European kids who are coming up, like Tatar and Nyquist, and they look like they're set for another run. And the Canadiens made the decision to go way younger in this offseason, and it seems to be largely paying off. So there's not a number of teams that you're competing with that you're kind of waiting to fall off, right? There's a number of solidly built teams that don't look like they're going anywhere. So if you're going to compete with those teams, you need to have a long-term plan. And maybe that's why you have to look at this roster and say, what's the future of this roster? Because I don't see it as currently constructed. I don't see a future where they can compete with these teams next to them, who are only going to get better as those kids grow older.
And there is no guarantee, of course, even if you blow it up. I mean, the Edmonton Oilers are that cautionary tale, but they do have nice young players, right? And eventually you would figure that team would figure it out and learn how to win. If they just get the old boys club out of the front office there, they'll be okay. But I mean, it's no guarantee, right?
They're a great test case for how many number one picks you can get without winning anything.
We'll see where they draft this year. But it seems everything I've read and understood from people who know about this year's draft, it's not just a two-player draft, McDavid and Eichel up top, pretty deep one. And it looks like the Maple Leafs going to be drafting in maybe the top five this year, which would be another good step towards increasing their good young players.
And if they can deal a couple of those complementary pieces that we were talking about, like a Lupul, or even if somebody might want to take Phaneuf's contract, or especially Cody Franzen, who's going to be a free agent anyway and is probably not going to be in the Leafs' plans considering he's going to command north of $5 million, those are the kind of assets you can flip and get a second-round pick, maybe a first-round pick, depending on what else you deal. And in a deep draft like that, that's what you want to do, right? That's sort of the New England Patriots mentality, is when your team starts to get old.
You've got to bring it back to football, don't you?
Always have to bring it back to football. But when it starts to get old, you want to stockpile those draft picks, because not all of them are going to pan out. But if you pick enough of them in a good draft, you're going to get something you can build with.
What a concept. The Toronto Maple Leafs stockpiling draft picks instead of sending them out the door. Have to see as the trade deadline does approach. When we come back, Raptors get blown out yet again, 110-89 at home to the East-leading Atlanta Hawks. They're good. The Raptors, all of a sudden, not so good. We'll discuss it, try to figure out why, even with the return of DeMar DeRozan and his 25 points yesterday, and the New Orleans Pelicans in town tomorrow afternoon. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Mike Johnson and Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Dan Robson.
The Vancouver Canucks captain and alternate captain, the Sedin brothers, Henrik and Daniel. They're also the team's most dynamic duo, and their chemistry together is legendary. But what's it like to be that third guy on Vancouver's top line? How do you fit in when you're skating with a pair of identical twins? We talked to 13 of their line mates to find out. There's Marcus Naslund, who grew up in the same Swedish town as the twins and played with them in Vancouver.
I just remember two twins following the older brother around.
There's Jason King, who played with them on what was nicknamed the mattress line.
They'll make a behind-the-back pass, or they'll make a no-look pass, and it's almost like the other one just kind of feels where the other one is at.
Curious about how to tell them apart? Their line mates have some tips.
Somebody told me this, and it sounds super creepy, but they have like a different shaped face.
But even if they do look different, it can be hard to figure out which is which. Just ask Brian Smolinski.
You think you got it? You know, you got it down, and then, you know, you don't see him on a day off or something. You come back the next day, and you're like, yeah, I totally forgot.
This is the story of Henrik and Daniel Sedin, told through the eyes of their line mates, the Sedin triplets.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I am Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Johnston. The Toronto Raptors lose yet again. It was a fun beginning portion of the season for the Raptors when they were first in the Eastern Conference. No longer are they first in the East, and now 5.5 games back of the Atlanta Hawks, tied with the Chicago Bulls 5.5 games back after yesterday's 110-89 loss down at the Air Canada Center. DeMar DeRozan now back for two games. He won his first game back, but, you know, it helps playing the Philadelphia 76ers in your return. And it seems like the minute restrictions are almost non-existent because he played 32 minutes last night, which was tied with Kyle Lowry for the most minutes of anybody on that team. Scored 25 points. So he looks like he's back in form, although he didn't have his, you know, normal high number of free throw attempts, only had four of them yesterday. But the Raptors now, all of a sudden, guys, you look at their recent play, ever since they went on this that West Coast road trip, they lost the first game in Chicago, won the next game against the Clippers in one of their better wins of the season, came right back next night in the high altitude of Denver and beat the Nuggets. Since then, and you can argue, actually, they played a pretty good game in Portland. The next game on that road trip, lost in overtime in one of the more exciting games of the season. But since then, they played their worst basketball of the season. Got a bunch of blowouts. One of them against the Warriors, which is understandable. One of them against the Suns, which is less understandable. Lost to Charlotte. Lost a close one to the Pistons, who were playing some pretty good basketball. And lost yesterday in blowout fashion to the Atlanta Hawks. Now, there was so much excitement, Mike, surrounding this team at the beginning of the season, and rightly so. Is some of the shine worn off it a little bit with the recent play?
It's only natural to. They're not playing good basketball right now. It's very sloppy. They're turning the ball over far too much. They're not playing well defensively. They need to, on the flip side, they're still in first place in their division by a mile. So it's okay that it's happening now because they have some leeway. They have some room to flounder, but they need to hit the reset button. They need to, they had a players only meeting, you mentioned off air, and that we've seen with teams in the past when players do that, it typically works out well, at least in the short term. It gives them a sense of urgency to change things up. DeMar coming back, he was one of the very few bright spots in last night's game. And that's a promising sign that he can come back and he can put up the points he was before his injury. Kyle Lowry, again, he also played well, those two, but no one else showed up. The turnovers were bad. And they were playing a great team, the hottest team in the NBA. What Dwayne Casey needs to do is maybe Dwayne doesn't need to do anything because the players had a meeting by themselves, but they need to just take a step back and say, guys, we have a great opportunity this year. The East is a very weak conference and we're one of the best teams in it. So we're guaranteed a playoff spot. We're going to have home court advantage, at least in the first round of the playoffs. There's a lot going for this team. Their record on paper is still good, but they can't finish the regular season playing the way they are now. Because if they run into a team like Cleveland in the first round, who hasn't done very well up until this point, it'll be cause for concern. They have to change something. They have to just take a step back, focus, say, guys, let's just remember what we were doing in the first quarter of the season. We were playing great team basketball. We were efficient. We were not turning the ball over the way we have been lately. Let's just get back to that. We're not going to be making a bunch of trades. We're not in panic mode. Everybody calm down. DeMar's back. Let's right the ship. And it's good that it's happening at this point of the season. So they have time to turn it around and then they can work towards peaking as the playoffs come around.
Well, it's a team that's playing with house money, right? Essentially,
right, exactly.
You look at what happened to them last year. They were ready to blow up the franchise and sort of sink back and hopefully get a top 10 pick and keep on building from the inside. And what happened when they traded Rudy Gay and all of a sudden the roster sort of coalesced to a team that has a distinct identity, which is honestly one of the best things you can have when you encounter adversity like this, because you do know what you have in that locker room. You know what you can fall back on. You have a coach who's familiar with the composition of the roster who can point out to them, these are your strengths. You know, you're built to play good defense. You're built to move it slowly on offense. And I think DeMar DeRozan said it the other day that what was happening while he was out is that they were just getting ahead of themselves. They're just trying to move the ball too fast, trying to push the play too much. And what was happening was they're turning the ball over. They're late getting back on defense. And that creates the kind of situation that can snowball. And before you know it, you find yourself having lost 7 and 9 games. I'm personally not worried at all about this team because of their strong identity, because of the fact that they were expected to be a playoff team, and they're going to be a playoff team,
but
and they
got
to win one round. That's the goal for this season. I don't care where they finish in the East. They got to win a playoff round.
Weren't expectations changed, though, a little bit with their early season play, or was it always, win a round in the playoffs? Was it not? Is it not been a moving target for this team, Jordan? Because you look at the way they played, and sitting atop the East for as long as they did, and some big wins against good Western teams. They've beaten Memphis this year. They've beaten the Clippers. They've beaten good teams.
And that's great.
On the road as
that's
well.
That's all positive. Like, those are all building blocks. I don't know if you saw Carl Kelly's column in the Globe a couple days ago where he talked about the Raptors' long, long, long-term plans that revolve around when Andrew Wiggins becomes a free agent in the top tier of Canada, Canadian basketball stars maybe wanting to come home. And that's all well and good. And I'm not so worried about that, about what's going to happen to Andrew Wiggins in 2021. That's a little bit too far down the road to think about. But what it does show to me is that this is a team that's thinking long term. And when you're thinking long term, you can't get wrapped up in, oh no, we've had a bad 10 games. We're losing sense of ourselves. We got to shake it up. We got to do this and that. You just have to stick with what's worked. And losing 7 of 9 games is a little too early to start thinking, oh no, this isn't working.
The counter argument to that would be, and Eric Kareen had a good story about this, I believe it was yesterday, after yesterday's game, about the fact that you might not have an opportunity like the Raptors have in the Eastern Conference. The Cavs will be better with LeBron James, assuming he's back. He's only on a 1-year deal, but can't imagine him leaving that Cleveland team until they win a title. But the East is going to be different next year. Those younger teams are going to be better. The Pistons, now that they've figured it out and can play that way for 82 games, you would think.
But the Raps are one of those younger teams, too, so they're going to be better.
Right. But right now, they are good. I mean, they are. We all understand they're one of the top four teams in the Eastern Conference. So that being said, would it not make sense to go out and add a piece before the deadline. Would it not make sense to try and bolster this lineup and try and get into an NBA Finals, which is not crazy talk?
Hey, it's always good to add a piece, depending on what you give up for it. I'm not going to sit here and be like, no, they shouldn't add anything.
Mortgaging a piece of the future, if that's what it takes to get a significant
piece.
Like
what? What are we talking about mortgaging?
I'm not going to do some pie-in-the-sky trade scenario.
No, but like who on the Raptors is a young piece that you think would have value around the rest of the NBA that
they
should give up?
Well, Terrence Ross is a guy that I think people have soured on. And might have some value.
I definitely have not soured on Terrence Ross. I don't think he's run into some walls recently, but the talent is off the charts.
He can definitely hit a three, and he helps space the floor, no question. But he has been very inconsistent, has not taken the step forward.
But we were just talking about not trading Maple Leafs at their low point.
Right.
So why are we trading Terrence Ross at his low point?
I'm just saying, is there not an argument to be made that maybe this is a go-for-it year for the Raptors, as crazy as that sounds?
It should be a go-for-it year. Heading into the season, their expectations based on last season had to be, we're going to win our division, but this year we have to win at least one playoff round. We're looking at the way the Eastern Conference has unfolded up until this point, the Raptors should change their expectations because they've pretty much locked down the fact they're going to win their division. So mid-season, do a little mid-season shift in the way you're thinking in your expectations. Now their expectations should be, we have to get to the NBA Finals. That is our championship at the moment.
Lofty goals all of a sudden.
Lofty goals, but in a relatively weak conference. I mean, the Atlanta Hawks are a very solid team, a deep team, much like the Raptors. Where it's not one or two guys that stand out. They're a very deep, well-constructed team, just like the Raptors. But other than the Atlanta Hawks, the Raptors they're right there.
But you're talking about changing expectations to be the NBA Finals. So you're now saying that they should sit down and say, well, if we don't make the NBA Finals this season, it was a lost year.
Well,
I don't think anybody would say that. If they go into the playoffs, win a round, get to the second round, and give some team a run in the second round, I think this season's a success, and they're built to grow from there.
They just can't rest on their laurels, right? They could coast for the rest of the season, still finished above 500, get a home playoff spot, and probably win one round. They're better than that. They're better than that. They've showed early in the season that they have the potential to challenge for an Eastern Conference title.
Not arguing there. I'm just saying that winning their division is just fine, and coasting for the rest of the season is just fine, because where the success or failure of this team will be determined is in the playoffs.
Yeah, the goalposts seemingly are changing day by day with the Toronto Raptors. When we come back, it is NFL Championship Sunday tomorrow. Packers, Seahawks, Colts, Patriots. We'll break it down, and we'll talk about Sexy Rexy in Buffalo. All that and more coming up next. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Johnson on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
This ain't like when you're at a game and sign up for a credit card just to get the prize and then you immediately cancel the credit card. Because there's no prize when you sign up for our radio shows at iTunes or with your favorite podcatcher. Sportsnet 590 The Fan on demand. Go ahead, lounge around in bed with a good magazine. We'll even read it to you. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live. Live. On Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Johnston. It is NFL Conference Championship Sunday. Tomorrow, early game, Packers, Seahawks, late game at 6:40, Colts and Patriots from Foxborough. Hopefully some lousy weather. I haven't seen that crazy lousy weather game. Lambeau was meh, from what I understand. I know,
you wanted the Ice Bowl too, and instead
right.
You got just November.
Right. Even last year, Niners-Packers, that was cold, man. Like, there was no snow, but it was like minus 1,000. So we haven't seen that this year. So hopefully, at least in New England, it's snowing or something. Seattle will probably be raining because that's what happens in Seattle. But yeah, lots to talk about from a football perspective. Let's, I guess, start in breaking down the two games, gents. You got the Seahawks, who are the defending champs. Bit of a slow-ish start to the season, although they hammered the Packers week one. But a lot of people talking about them kind of taking a laissez-faire attitude and the fact that they are the defending champs and nobody's repeated. It's so difficult. All of a sudden, that defense is back to its Super Bowl caliber. And they're going to need to be that way against arguably the best quarterback in the NFL right now in Aaron Rodgers, even though he is a little banged up. Jordan, how do we look at this one? I mean, it's sexy on paper. It's a rematch as well from week one, and week one was not close.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, I think, because the Packers have certainly gotten their offense together a lot since that week one. They kind of started slowly as well as the Seahawks. But to me, the real key for the Seahawks was getting Bobby Wagner back in shape. He's their star middle linebacker, and he had a really bad ankle injury that kept him out for some of those weeks. And those were the weeks that everybody was like, what's wrong with the Seattle defense? Well, they were missing the guy who calls the plays from the middle of it. And I think that Aaron Rodgers is going to make this game a really tight one. He can make throws into tight windows, and that's exactly how you have to beat the Seahawks. In week one, they didn't go at Richard Sherman at all. I think they threw one, maybe two passes to his side of the field the entire game. I would be shocked if they didn't just take some shots in his direction, because they can't afford, with Rodgers' calf already sort of limiting his mobility, they can't afford to take any options away on the field. So it's going to be great. It's going to be the best quarterback in football against the best set of defensive backs in football. Best on best, man.
And a guy like Jordy Nelson, you have to give a player like that the chance to make a play against a guy like Richard Sherman. Jordy Nelson was a top three receiver this year. He had an outstanding season, and he's capable of that big play. And the way Seattle's defense has been playing lately, the Packers are going to need one or two big plays, in my opinion, to stay in this game. Because after when Wagner came back and after they got rid of Percy Harvin, it took a few weeks for the Seahawks to come together, and they're peaking. The last few weeks, they've been the best team in football just from an eye test. They've been outstanding. Russell Wilson can manage a game as well as pretty much any quarterback in the league. And like you said, the battle here is going to be the Packers offense versus the Seahawks defense, because I think the Seahawks offense has the advantage over the Packers defense as well, the way they've been playing.
Maybe. But the interesting part about that kind of battle on that side of the field is if this game turns into a high scoring shootout, and if we're looking at a second half score that requires the Seahawks to go downfield, they have very little in the receiver position,
right,
especially with Paul Richardson, who was showing some real flashes as a rookie going out with a serious knee injury. So they can't afford to let it turn into a shootout. So they've got to come right at Rodgers, because if Rodgers throws for 300 yards and three touchdowns, the Seahawks are probably losing that game.
And the Packers are a very different team on the road this year, as most teams are in the NFL. But you look at their four losses, all of them coming away from Lambeau, perfect 8-0 in Green Bay. And the Seahawks, I mean, I guess it's not quite the fortress it was last year in Seattle. They lost one home game this year. Of course, that was to the Dallas Cowboys. But that's a difficult place to play. But you look at the Packers and some of their, I mean, they've laid some clunkers on the road this year. They lost to what we found out was a bad New Orleans Saints team and got blown out 44-23 in week 8 at the Superdome, which is, again, another tough place to play. They lost in Buffalo to a great defense. But, yeah, they all four of their losses coming on the road, that week 1 game was in Seattle. How much of a factor is that, the 12th man and everything, Mike?
I think the Buffalo game is a good game to look at in the sense that the Packers are going to be entering a similar environment, probably a much more hostile environment against a better defense. They really struggled. The Bills have a great defense, but they're not on, no one's on Seattle's level of the remaining teams, and they're going to face a very similar challenge, and they didn't respond well in that Buffalo game, and they're going to have to do much better. They're going to have the thing with Aaron Rodgers is, a lot of people are going to be talking about his injured leg. In the second half last week, it didn't affect him. He had an outstanding second half, and his release is so quick, it makes up for a lack of mobility. But if you point to the Buffalo game, that's a
Rodgers was terrible in that game.
He was pressured. The Bills got a lot of pressure on him. Seattle's going to try to do the same thing. They are healthy on defense, and they have been starching teams. They've been playing outstanding football. I would be more surprised if Green Bay beat Seattle than if the Colts beat the Patriots this
weekend. Here's the one thing about Green Bay's offense is it's built to put up a large chunk of yards, and it's built to take them in big chunks at a time. And it's a very well-oiled machine. But if you can disrupt the receivers downfield and make Rodgers hold on to the ball a little longer than he'd like, you can really throw a kink in that machine. And when that happens, the whole thing kind of tends to break down, right? It's built on a very specific way of moving the football. And you saw, Mike's exactly right, that Buffalo game was a pretty good blueprint for how to do it. And the Seahawks have a very similar defense, but with a little better personnel in the defensive backfield.
The late game, the 6:40 game, is the Patriots, the AFC Championship game. The 12-4 Patriots hosting the 11-5 Indy Colts, who kind of limped to the finish line, and it helped that they clinched that division in like week three. It's not a good division, and there were some question marks as to the validity of their goodness, let's say. How good was this team really? Well, they appear to be pretty good. They laid a beatdown on the Broncos last week, which might have been the sexier matchup, Manning and Brady this week. But as it stands, it's a rematch of another regular season matchup, and the Patriots hammered them 42-20 in week 11. That was coming off a bye. And we know that as good as Bill Belichick is, his playoff losses have come in rematches of regular season affairs. It's so difficult to beat a team twice in 1 year, Jordan. And this Colts team, I know you think they're clicking on all cylinders right now.
Yeah, they're a team that's very different from the guys that lost in New England earlier. For one thing, they've gotten a lot better at stopping the run with Arthur Jones now back and really clogging things up in the middle. Their secondary has really improved. You could have made a great case that what they showed last week against the Broncos was one of the better secondary performances we've seen all year. I mean, not only did they break up passes, they were getting in there and getting physical to the point that you saw Sanders and Demaryius Thomas actually dropping passes. So it's a better defense, I think, than people give them credit for. They finally come to their senses and sat down Trent Richardson, who was a disaster, and Boom Heron. The jury's still out on whether he's going to be a viable long-term running back in the NFL, but he can certainly catch passes out of the backfield, and he can get more than 2 yards per carry, which automatically is an upgrade. And then there's Andrew Luck, who might be, aside from Aaron Rodgers, the best quarterback in football right now. I think these games on Sunday are going to be excellent because you have two of the best-built, best-coached franchises in football in the Seahawks and Patriots going against two of the very best quarterbacks of the last few years. And that makes for high drama.
The matchup I talked about week 11, the 42-20 win for the Patriots over the Colts, was the Jonas Gray game, where he went berserk with his four touchdowns out of nowhere, and then he went back into obscurity immediately following that.
He'll be back this week, I bet.
Well, I mean, it. You talk about adjustments and rematches and the fact that Bill Belichick is... You know, the rare times he has problems in the playoffs is rematches of regular season affairs. I'm sure the Colts are looking at game film of that matchup, Mike, and saying, well, I know that was the game plan to beat us back then in week 11, but certainly not going to let you beat us on the ground that way again this week.
That's true. But, you know, Belichick, he's so savvy that he's probably not going to come into to tomorrow's game thinking, okay, we'll just do what we did last time because it worked really well. He's not that type of coach. There's so many layers to a Bill Belichick game plan. He's going to probably do the opposite of what the Colts expect him to do because that's what Bill Belichick does, and everyone knows his track record, right? If they can get pressure on Andrew Luck, and that's not always a difficult thing to do against the Colts. They've had some trouble protecting him this year. You're going to have to force him out of the pocket and trust your defensive backs to shut down T.Y., to shut down Moncrief, and the two tight ends. You know, Luck has some good weapons, but he doesn't have these A-list weapons. And New England's defense is pretty good. It's always focused the attention on Tom Brady and the offense, Gronkowski, how they're going to approach a game, but their defense is pretty underrated. And much like Arthur is going to be key on the Colts side, Chandler, it's the Jones Bowl this week, is going to be very key in putting pressure on Andrew Luck this week. And I think that's going to be just as important as how the Patriots do on offense, is how they're able to keep Andrew Luck off balance and not give him time to make a play, because you can't count Andrew Luck out of any football game. He's my favorite player to watch, any position, CFL, NFL. You can't count this guy out of the game, even if he doesn't have the pieces around him.
Well, I think what you're going to see, and you saw a little bit of it last week, is that this New England Patriots defense, which is better than they've had in years, probably better than they've had since they were back winning Super Bowls in the early part of the 2000s, is that when everything works right, they're an elite unit. But they can be attacked, and you saw Joe Flacco do it last week, where you just sort of push the ball at those defensive backs, and you rely on your receivers to either make plays, draw contact, get the ball moving via penalties. You saw Darrelle Revis take a couple of penalties last week, which is not something he used to do, and they did that because Flacco forced the ball into his coverage to Steve Smith and Torrey Smith and made Revis make plays. And he can definitely make plays, and he might even pick off a pass, but if you can keep attacking him, he's also going to make some mistakes. And the one thing that the Patriots haven't really seen too much of, and it didn't happen so much in Week 11, is Andrew Luck running the football. The Colts were very circumspect with calling his number. He freelanced a little bit with his feet this year, but they're very circumspect calling his number because they didn't want to risk an injury. Now that the stakes are high, he can take off, and he's a quarterback that loves contact. Like, he runs to contact. You see him throw a pick, he will race downfield to make the tackle. So he's not afraid to do that. And when you're trying to get Chandler Jones to get pressure on him in the pocket, you have to be very careful for him to escape the pocket and either take off up the field or make those short little out passes to Dan Heron, which we've seen from the last couple of weeks can turn into big gains.
This is Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Johnston. I know it's a week ago, but it's the first show we've had since the Dez Bryant non-catch. And I know, Jordan, you want to go off on this thing, as many people have in the last week. I don't know if I've heard an opinion that's pro the rule that allowed that to be called an incomplete pass, but it certainly seems like something that the NFL should, if not, that they will address that rule this offseason.
The reason you haven't heard anybody with an opinion that's pro that catch is because you've probably been asking people who like and watch football if that was a good call.
Yes.
And the answer is they all hate it because it took away a fantastic game-winning catch from one of the NFL's best receivers. And if you're a league in any sport that's trying to improve your product and sell your product and market your product, and you've got a rule that takes the best players in your game and makes their best plays illegal, you've really screwed up somewhere along the way. And you saw this in the NHL a few years ago when they eliminated the two-line pass because they wisely realized that any play that was denying breakaways to your all-stars is bad luck for the league. And the fact that Dez Bryant and Calvin Johnson have been denied touchdowns over this, and Odell Beckham Jr. is losing his mind on Twitter about these catches not being not being allowed, just means the rule has to change. I think we were talking about, you know, a bunch of people are all watching this game and everybody is on their feet screaming, and then all of a sudden it's called off. It's like the foot in the crease rule all over again.
Yeah,
you know, the NFL is built on playoff moments, you know, the drive and things like that. And this could have been one of those moments. And now people are going to look back at this game and view the NFL in a negative light.
It could have been the catch it's the call.
Exactly. Exactly. And the NFL has an image problem right now in a lot of areas. And they're just, you know, they can't get out of their own way when it comes to things like this, when it comes to not to mention everyone's saying, oh, it's a stupid rule, but it was the right call. I don't even think they called it correctly because he had 2 feet down and made a football play. If stretching the ball out to the goal line is not considered a football play, what's a football play? That's the point of the game. That's why you play, is to get the ball across the goal line. So I don't even think they made the right call in that sense either, but I digress. The NFL really blew it. And if the NFL in the offseason, this should be one of the first things they go after, and just like, all right, guys, let's tweak the rule. Let's tweak the rule. Let's look at what constitutes a catch. Let's maybe be a little more lenient when it comes to completing the process of a catch. In college, the players that make up the NFL come from college, and you only need 1 foot in bounds, and then you get to the NFL, and there's more catch rules. You know, there's more you have to deal with. It makes it more difficult create offense.
Yeah, it's so nuts that a play that is fantastic and exciting at the college level is somehow denied at the professional level. This entire season has been one long showcase of how football can succeed despite itself. The fact that people are still watching the NFL, still tuning in record numbers, despite the league basically doing everything they possibly can to make people angry at the product is frankly amazing.
People like them some football. So let's continue to talk about it. The Buffalo Bills have a new head coach, and it's a guy who's going to make at least the press conferences or media conferences interesting post-game in Rex Ryan. And he did not disappoint in his first foray into the Western New York media as he made some comments guaranteeing playoff berths and talking about not being satisfied with this defense being fourth in the NFL. They're going to be first next year. Is this the right hire for this team, Jordan?
Well, first of all, I thought that, you know, the world had really shifted to an anti-bullying kick. And all of a sudden, Rex Ryan's hosting a press conference and they're going to bully other teams and we're going to be the schoolyard bullies and it's going to be great. Rex Ryan is an entertaining guy and you're going to have some fun press conferences for sure. But the bottom line is that Rex Ryan's strengths don't help the Buffalo Bills' weaknesses. The Bills' problem has been at quarterback.
He doesn't play quarterback.
He doesn't play quarterback. He doesn't coach quarterbacks. He doesn't develop quarterbacks. And he can't do anything with quarterbacks other than game plan around them so that the rest of his team can win despite them playing poorly.
I know it was a long time ago. He did get to AFC Championship with Mark Sanchez.
Yeah, and some awful quarterbacks have won Super Bowls, but lightning doesn't strike there very often. And if you want, and that was in 2010, and since then, it's only been 4 or 5 years, but the game has become even more quarterback-centric and even more passing-oriented. So, you know, Rex Ryan is a relic from another time of football, and I think you saw him and Doug Whaley both discussing, well, our game plan and our belief is that you have to run the ball to win. And that's, like, that's literally talking about the horse and buggy in the NFL these days.
You know, I think if you look at a team like the Seattle Seahawks, granted, they have an excellent quarterback, and it's something clearly the Bills need, but they're built on a run-heavy offense and a strong defense. And if the Bills want to mirror that, you can still have success in the NFL.
Cowboys did a whole lot of running
this
year. But those run games work because the threat of your quarterback going downfield with accuracy is there.
This is true. It's a great point. Rex Ryan coming in, it might not help the quarterback situation immediately, but they're already a very good defensive team, and he's got a great jumping off point because their defense is so strong. He's a great defensive coach. He won a Super Bowl with the Ravens as a defensive coordinator, and just so happens that their quarterback that year was the almighty Trent Dilfer. So,
Dilfer's taken more slings and arrows since he won that Super Bowl.
He's a Super Bowl champion.
He is like the go-to guy for the worst quarterback to win a Super Bowl.
He develops elite quarterbacks. That's what he does for his job, right?
He's a good broadcaster.
He's a good talent scout.
Yeah.
Smart guy.
Well, I think this move really, if you're a Bills fan, this move, you know, it has to, even though there is quarterback, you know, they need a quarterback or they need Manuel to really turn into something special. Turn into a quarterback. Yeah, if I was a Bills fan, I would be happy about this. I would be at least optimistic about they almost made the playoffs this year. They were right into it until 2 weeks remaining in the season when they blew it against Oakland. They were right there in a strong.
They blew that Chiefs game too. The Chiefs game, I think. Well, I mean, it's the Raiders, but the Chiefs game, they with the fumbles of the muff punts and the fumbles late in that game.
Also, if you flub out from the playoffs with a loss to the Oakland Raiders, you probably didn't deserve to be in the playoffs.
Yeah, tough one.
That's true, but they were there until late in the season in the AFC, which was very strong this season. If just listening to Rex Ryan, maybe I was getting caught up in his.
He sold you.
That's what Rex does.
Within the first 10 seconds, he dropped one cliche, happy to be here, honored to be a coach. And then he started with the bully talk. And then he started with the, you know, it's been 15 years. We're there. We're going. We're going to the playoffs. And if you're a Bills fan, if you're a Bills player, that's got to motivate you. That's got to, you know, guys, we were close this season. there's no reason why we won't be just as good on defense, and we can improve on offense. They had a lot of injuries to their running backs. If they can get a healthy run game going, it will ease the pressure on whoever the quarterback is going to end up being. It's not, I know some people don't like the hiring. I really like the hiring. I think.
Okay. I don't want to completely rain on the Buffalo Bills parade because Rex Ryan gives them
They've
an identity
enough, man.
And it's nice, but look, you had a lot of injuries to your running backs because one of them is made of glass and the other one is going on 34 years old. You know, you had problems making the playoffs because you play in a league against Bill Belichick, who has since 2010 and Rex Ryan's last winning is 1-7 against Bill Belichick coach teams. And you said, you know, it's going to take pressure off whoever's going to be the quarterback. Well, I hope that mythical quarterback that they're going to secure is pretty good. The Buffalo Bills have a great defense and they have some talent elsewhere. Sammy Watkins certainly looks like he's ready to be a number one receiver for, you know, the next several years. And Robert Woods actually looked like he could be an effective number two. Beyond that, there's not a lot to build around on the offensive side of the ball. And what good is having elite receivers if you can't get them the ball? If I was a Bills fan right now, I would be excited for the press conferences and, you know, crossing my fingers and hoping that this can somehow be different, because this is the same talk we heard from Rex Ryan before each of the last five New York Jets seasons, which ended terribly.
Yeah, they didn't go that well. No question about it. The expectations were a little different in Denver this year, and they cleaned house almost immediately. Who knows what the future holds for Peyton Manning? Some very cryptic comments after the way that game ended. But out is John Fox, and didn't take him very long to land a new gig. He's in Chicago with the Bears, and the Broncos still kind of looking out there and trying to figure out what they do going forward. But John Fox, I mean, we talked about this before we went on the air today, Mike, in that it's such an interesting scenario in the NFL when you've got teams getting eliminated from the playoffs and then immediately firing their coach, where you've got teams who have already been in coach searching modes since the season ended, week 17. It kind of adds that extra layer of intrigue.
It does. It certainly adds another layer of intrigue. I don't even know if I'm a fan of it. I'd rather just wait, because there are coordinators on teams that are still playing that are going to be considered for head coaching jobs, and their names come up, and it kind of takes the attention away from their team. It could be a distraction. So fire all the coaches you want once you're eliminated, but then, you know, just wait until after the season before you start speaking to coaches and hiring. That's just personally, that's how I would like to see it.
I mean, it's kind of neat for the intrigue, but it does kind of feel like tampering, right?
A little bit. I mean, these guys are still in the playoffs and their names are being brought up in discussions. Oh, he's a you know, head coaching candidate for whatever team needs a coach, because there's always at least half a dozen teams that need a new coach, right?
And how do you feel if, you know, if you're a linebacker and, you know, you're playing for Jack Del Rio and you're trying to get ready for the Colts game, and, you know, you're hearing that, oh, well, my coach who's developed me and supported me throughout my career might be out the door as soon as we lose another game?
Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously these coaches are going to be focused on winning tomorrow, but you get the sense that maybe it's almost like they have a one foot out the door. If they have a great head coaching opportunity, and they might not be, you know, it will clearly be on their mind come tomorrow if their name is out there.
Especially they know, so, you know, the rumors are already out there. You know, Oakland wants to talk to Jack Del Rio. Somebody else wants to talk to whoever. And they know that sort of whatever happens in that game, there's a nice cushion for them to fall into, you know, because all of a sudden the Raiders are all of a sudden not going to be like, well, you lost that game there against the Colts, so now we don't want to talk to you for our head coaching position. You know, one game's not going to matter. And then they're looking at a nice, nice golden parachute.
You love the Jack Del Rio hiring, Jordan. I know that you're kind of on an island in that regard. There's not a lot of people that like, well, frankly, much of what the Raiders have done the last 10 years or so.
I don't like much of what the Raiders have done
but you
the
like
last
this
10
one.
Years either. Yeah, I do. Jack Del Rio was a really good coach for the Jaguars for a long time. He took that franchise, and made them legitimate. You know, he had the stones to go with David Garrard as his quarterback when nobody sort of thought he was ready. Went 11-5 that year, almost won the AFC South.
Wears those great suits on the sideline.
Looks sharp, which is half the battle, and did a great job with the defense in Denver as well. And I think, when I look at the Raiders roster, Certainly defense is their strength. They've got a couple of great young linebackers in Sio Moore and Khalil Mack, and that's going to help anybody build a defense. And when you're struggling, when you've struggled for as long as the Raiders have, and you've been looking for an identity for so long, to have a coach who, A, really wants to be there because a lot of his family is from that area and supports that area, and B, knows what he wants to do with a football team and knows what the personnel is and how to build upon its strengths, I think that that's a positive thing. I think, honestly, anything that gives the Oakland Raiders a forward direction is a positive thing, and Del Rio definitely brings that.
I'm with you on that. And another thing the Raiders have going for them, we talk about how important quarterbacks are. Derek Carr is a pretty good young quarterback. He had a solid rookie season.
Looked promising.
He looked
sure.
very promising on a team that was not a good football team. If I was an Oakland Raiders fan, I would be more optimistic, than a lot of Tennessee Titans fans and teams like that that are trending downward. I think the Raiders are trending up because you mentioned a couple of their guys on defense, Mack and outstanding, like blue chip. These guys are going, you can build a defense around these types of players. And, you know, the Oakland Raiders, they've got,
see, I'm not on an island. All We're right, on, not an island on an island together.
They just, peninsula.
They got to remember to stop celebrating behind the line of scrimmage for, 45 seconds.
That was when you're play. A Raider, you take your celebrations where you can find them.
That was the most Oakland Raiders play of the season.
Which is saying a lot.
Yeah. Before we take the break here, some news that doesn't involve a player that currently plays in the NFL. And you know what? Might never play in the NFL, but was intriguing for the possibilities of where he could go in the NFL draft. Cardale Jones will go back to Ohio State for another season, and who knows if he'll even be the starter there next year. He was the third stringer headed into this year. Only played three games, but led that team to a national championship. He's massive. He's 6'5", 6,000 pounds, but throws a rocket of a football. And if it were me, I don't know if I could ever turn down what would probably, and Darren Revell tweeted that it was probably around $3 million he gave up if he goes late second round, considering this some sort of endorsement deal and getting a million-ish bucks guaranteed from whoever drafted him. I don't know if I could ever advise someone to turn that one down, Jordan.
Especially somebody for whom it seemed like lightning kind of struck,
Right
place, right
time.
What if
he stinks? What if he does stink?
Puts up three great games. Could enter a draft that doesn't have a lot of quarterback talent in
Plus,
it. Now is the time.
And you don't have the pressure of being a number one overall pick. You're not going to start in the NFL if you do get drafted in the late second round or anything. You can kind of develop on the practice squad in practice.
Yeah, and there's no guarantee that next year he'll be even one of the top 10 quarterbacks in college football. There any number of new recruits could come out and top him. It just seems, kudos to the kid, because he seems to think that he has a lot more to learn and he wants to develop and he wants to go back to school. And, that's all well and good. But, yeah, I really think he missed, this golden opportunity here.
I'll play a devil's advocate and just play off a little bit what you said. You have to respect the guy for going back to school. If that's clearly it's what he wants,
I'm
right?
I'm too cynical to believe that
Me
it's
too.
About that.
Yeah.
And if you look at it from a football perspective, he is very raw. He has some great tools. He has the size to be, he makes Ben Roethlisberger look small, right?
Yeah.
He has the tools, but he's so raw. He didn't play. He only started, three games all
three games.
Season? And you can't just throw a guy like that into the NFL because maybe, he gets drafted. Maybe he just gets cut. I guess he'd have a bit more money, but he's doing what he wants to do. You have to respect the kid for making the decision to
stay
in school.
What if he starts 14 games next year and he stinks?
Yeah, that's the question, right? What if he does stink? And he's
three
not
games
drafted.
Is nothing, right? You can have, anybody can have three good games. I think probably if you look through the whole game log, Jamarcus Russell probably had three good games in the NFL. Okay, maybe not Jamarcus.
Yeah, maybe.
But
that is the cautionary tale. And I guess, I am cynical. And I know he says he wants to be the first member of his family to actually earn a degree and earn a diploma before he heads to the NFL. I'm a little too cynical. And I do believe he's done the math. And if he is a first round pick, top five pick, first overall pick, the money's just going to be so much more significant.
For the record, you are allowed to earn a degree and diploma while you play or after you play in the NFL. It's not like you can
yes.
never, ever set foot in an institute of higher learning once you get drafted.
That's a good point as well. When we come back, the Blue Jays with some curious moves when it comes to arbitration eligible players. We'll talk about what's the latest with Josh Donaldson. Maybe get a comment in about Toronto FC and Marty Brodeur taking a week off. Looks like the writing's on the wall for him. This is Sportsnet Magazine Live on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
With a taste of what's inside the current issue of Sportsnet Magazine, here's Dave Serum.
He was just another normal kid from Chicago's South Side. He grew up loving basketball, but nobody ever gave him much of a chance. A gifted guard, the kid with glasses could never quite stand out from the crowd. Until he did.
Did what?
Peek-a-boo! I blew up the baby!
When Anthony Davis grew nearly a foot and put on 20 pounds of muscle during his junior season of high school, he turned heads. Soon, he'd be the best player in the country, the top recruit and a national champ in his 1 year at Kentucky. But the question remained, could he live up to the pressures of being the NBA's first overall pick? This issue, one man, one team, and one league that will never forget the name, Anthony Davis.
Jumper lost the handle. Vincent has it. He's blocked by Davis. No foul committed, and Kentucky will take it. Davis off the block by Anthony Davis.
This story and more appears in the latest edition of Sportsnet Magazine, available on Next Issue and in the Apple Newsstand.
Sportsnet Magazine Live, Sportsnet Radio Network. I'm Ben Ennis alongside Jordan Heath Rawlings and Mike Johnston. The Blue Jays signing a couple of players before the arbitration deadline yesterday. Michael Saunders and Marco Estrada inking 1 year deals, but a couple of guys did not. And one of them, the most significant pickup by anybody really this offseason so far, there's a couple of free agents still out there, but Josh Donaldson coming over in that trade from the Oakland A's did not agree to a deal before the deadline yesterday. So they had to exchange arbitration numbers. He's looking for $5.75 million for next season. The Blue Jays countering at $4.3 million. And the way Major League Baseball arbitration works, the arbitrator has to pick one of the two. Cannot go somewhere in the middle. And the way the Blue Jays operate, they will now, according to team policy, and they've held true to this, will not do a one-year deal between now and arbitration. So they will either go to arbitration with Josh Donaldson, or they will sign him to a multi-year deal. And as per team policy, they won't do a multi-year deal unless they're buying out at least 1 year of his free agent eligibility, which would be a longer term deal. You're looking at 5 years then.
And an expensive deal.
And a very expensive deal for Josh Donaldson. So it really does seem like the Blue Jays are going to go to arbitration for the first time since 1997, guys. And I know it's, you know, it's part of the game and everybody, it's you're supposed to be professional about it. But what arbitration is you're talking to an arbitrator. You are arguing with the player as to the player's value. And we saw what happened with PK Subban, who was present for the arbitration hearing that only lasted a couple of hours before the Canadians freaked out and saw how the way it was going and said, we need to get this done immediately. Is this the best way, Jordan, to start your relationship with a guy who's going to be a linchpin of your offense?
Well, it's probably not the best way, but it might be the most economical way. And certainly it's a business, and you can't fault the Blue Jays for deciding that, you know, we have 4 years of control. Part of the reason they gave up so much to get Josh Donaldson is because he was an outstanding slugger with 4 years left of team control. So, you know, they'd be foolish not to take advantage of that. I can see the point of view that says, well, the difference between 4.3 and 5.75 is kind of negligible if it keeps him happy. But at the same time, I mean, Josh Donaldson's not yet worn a Blue Jays uniform in a game right now. And, you know, so you have to go in and assess his value cold. And obviously, The idea of having arbitration eligible players with years of team control is that it keeps costs down. And if that $1.7 million or whatever it is ends up being enough so that the Blue Jays can go out and get a better reliever, which they badly need, then it's probably a good move.
It is, but it seems like penny pinching, doesn't it, Mike?
Well, with arbitration, there's always the potential for conflict between player and organization, like you were saying. So whenever any player goes to arbitration, I'm always a little hesitant. It's like, why did it get to this point? But with Donaldson, come spring training, this will be water under the bridge. Even if he gets a bit more money through arbitration, the Blue Jays are not going to be concerned about that. That's probably not going to prevent them from making a big move should they want to make a big move. And Donaldson he would be a bargain at twice his salary. So
five times.
Exactly, right? Come spring training, this, I believe, will be water under the bridge, and it's just maybe a little hiccup right now. But
if this was 3 years from now and Josh Donaldson had 1 year left of team control and we were talking about going to arbitration and potentially starting a big fight with him and, you know, then probably turning him off the idea of signing a long-term deal, then I'd be more worried about it. But, you know, this is a process that unless the Blue Jays suddenly decide to buy out his remaining years of eligibility, this is a process that's going to be repeated every year.
Right.
So, you know, it's just part of the business until, like I say, this you get into the last year and then you start talking, okay, well, we'll buy the 2 years left or 1 year left of your arbitration in exchange for, you know, buying the first 3 or 4 years of your free agency. And then you're talking a $20 million a year deal.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is there's a reason they haven't done this since 1997. It's not an enjoyable practice.
It's not ideal, for sure.
No. And, I mean, it's a significant amount when you're talking about over $1 million in the case of Donaldson, and apparently they are up against it so much that could actually make a difference when it comes to adding a piece maybe in the bullpen or whatever. But you've also got Danny Valencia, who is asking for $1.675 million. And the Blue Jays are countering at $1.25 million. You're looking at a difference of $400,000. Really? Are we going to go to arbitration over $400,000? That seems a little ridiculous.
But the optics are worse for your Josh Donaldson, your Josh Donaldson debate if you then are giving in to somebody like Danny Valencia but won't give Josh what he wants. That seems to be a little hypocritical. I'm sure it would seem that way to him.
Yeah, no question. We got to talk about the biggest move of the offseason so far for the Blue Jays. Munenori Kawasaki is back. And I jest, and people get upset for some reason when the Blue Jays bring back Munenori Kawasaki. He's on a minor league deal. He's going to be minor league depth. He's going to start the season and ideally spend the entire season, save for September, in Buffalo with the Bisons. But it seems like every year, Mike, we talk about the fact that if he's on this Blue Jays team, something terrible has gone wrong. And he keeps ending up on this Blue Jays team.
I know, and that's why they don't make the playoffs, because it's things happen that, you know, they have dealt with a lot of injuries the last few years. And at times, Kawasaki can come up and he can, you know, give a little energy to the lineup and he can make some defensive plays. And he's not a terrible baseball player, but you're right. If he's in the Blue Jays, if he's a Blue Jays starter, or maybe if they sign him to a deal that's not a minor league deal and they just signed him, there maybe would be cause for concern, but it's a minor league deal. He's a guy that, you know, that moves the needle. He's a fan favorite. So there's always going to be headlines around him, but it's a minor league deal. And if the Blue Jays come out this season and start winning and, you know, the top five in their lineup is as good as any in baseball, if they start producing, people are going to soon forget, about Kawasaki. They won't forget about him, but they won't be calling his name as often. You know, his name won't come up nearly
as
frequently.
There's certainly an awful lot of people who bought those jerseys and t-shirt jerseys who are very grateful for that little re-signing. Personally, if it was me, just with the luck the Jays have had the last couple of years, I might have let him walk just because he's almost a talisman because he's sitting there in Buffalo. And, well, you know, it seems like he's fated to play in Toronto. So as long as you have him down there waiting, somebody's going to get hurt in the infield and he's going to have to play. But you know what? Honestly, he's not the most talented baseball player in the world, but his teammates love him, and he's a fun guy to watch, and he gives, you know, great interviews in his own way, and, you know, so you throw a little bit of money around him, you keep him around, and you hope he never has to play.
Yeah, you need some guys like that.
He's a mascot.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ace is going to be looking over his shoulder once again this season, and I still think YouTube is 55% at least, maybe, Munenori Kawasaki clips. Some great ones post game, and he's had some big hits as well. Let's not forget.
He's a ball player, not a great ball player, but he's a ball player.
Yeah, and you know what? For the limited skills that he was born with, he certainly knows how to maximize them. Gents, it's been great. Thanks a lot for this.
Thank you.
Anytime.
When I come back, I got another hour for you. We'll talk a little more Raptors with Leo Routens and Mike Wilner. We will continue the Blue Jays conversation. This has been Sportsnet Magazine Live with Jordan Heath-Rawlings and Mike Johnson. I'm Ben Ennis, Sportsnet Radio Network.